Cleveland's Division of Police began using ShotSpotter, a gunshot detection technology, in 2020. It's designed to alert police to an area where a gunshot has been fired so they can get there fast and catch a suspect or help a victim or both. The current ShotSpotter contract costs the city $2.7 million, and now that the contract is up for renewal, IdeaStream is looking into how effective the technology is and whether it's making Cleveland and its residents safer. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll talk to IdeaStream criminal justice reporter Matt Richman about his in-depth look into the ShotSpotter program. He'll also tell us what the critics of the technology say. Later in the show, we're going to focus on the quest for food justice in Cleveland and hear why food apartheid has historically kept health away from Black communities. That's the topic of a City Club forum hosted by IdeaStream's Marlene Harris-Taylor tonight. First, the news. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. It's been 3 years since the Cleveland Police Department started using a gunshot detection technology called ShotSpotter. How it works, it's a network of microphones that scattered around the city that are used to detect and locate gunshots, and it sends information to officers on patrol. The goal has always been for ShotSpotter to help police officers better respond to and investigate crime and to help victims. The city of Cleveland paid $2.7 million for a 2-year ShotSpotter contract, and there are critics that question whether it really works in helping keep the streets of Cleveland safer. In fact, as Cleveland is deciding the future of ShotSpotter as a crime-fighting tool, officials in Dayton decided to do away with the technology altogether. But here in Cleveland, Mayor Justin Bibb believes in ShotSpotter as a part of the city's fight against gun crime. To talk more about this and about his in-depth reporting, IdeaStream's criminal justice reporter Matt Richman is here with me in studio. Matt, thanks so much for coming in.
Morning, Jenny.
Good morning. If you'd like to join the conversation, have a question for Matt, you can call us 866-578-0903 or 216-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org or you can tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. So, Matt, the Cleveland Division of Police started using ShotSpotter as part of a 2-year pilot program. Tell us more about the area in Cleveland it covered and how the technology kind of works. Give us those details.
Yeah, so initially it was in 3 square miles in the 4th District, the 4th Police District, which is the southeast side of Cleveland. And It's a network of microphones that are set up on utility poles and the tops of buildings, but it's not, because they're owned by a private company, they don't release the locations of the microphones. They just say generally we put them up on buildings and utility poles. And it picks up all sounds, and then there is there's an algorithm that kind of determines the sounds that are likely gunshots.
Hmm.
And then when it kind of has something that it thinks might be a gunshot, a human technician looks at it and kind of determines whether it's in fact a gunshot. If it is, then the location and the kind of the time and how many shots were fired. I mean, and the little details about, what kind of gun it might have been.
Oh, really?
Yeah, basically like it was a high caliber, low caliber, basic stuff. Is sent to patrol cars and to dispatch, and it's supposed to get those alerts into patrol cars to dispatch them quicker than through a 911 call and with a more accurate location than if somebody called and said they in their house and they heard a gunshot outside somewhere.
Now, Matt, according to your reporting, what do the numbers and data show when it comes to how effective this technology is in helping police respond to gun-related crimes?
So we've asked for information about arrests that are linked to these ShotSpotter alerts and all the ShotSpotter alerts that have come in, which is, thousands in the last three years. And what we've received from the city is the arrests linked to the first 2 years in that pilot project, just that period of time. And we looked at it in two ways. The total arrests that they sent along, there were 56 arrests in those two years. And out of those, 37 were just for an illegal gun possession, whether it's that you were, if you're carrying a gun and you have a felony on your record, then that's illegal. If you were carrying a gun in a car in a way that's, you know, accessible as you're driving, that's called improper handling in a motor vehicle. That's another charge. And then, you know, it used to be that you could get just charged for carrying a concealed weapon without a permit. Those were the most common charges. And then we also went in and looked at what happened when those arrests went to court. And so out of the 56, we found that, you know, just going on the online dockets, that only 42 of them ended up with court cases. And then, you know, looking further, you know, 18 of those court cases were for violent crimes. But for one reason or another, whether they were, you know, a couple cases a person was found not guilty, a couple cases of charges were dismissed. But in the end, only 8 people in those two years were convicted of committing a violent crime.
As connected to the ShotSpotter technology.
Yeah, right.
And then I saw a statistic in one of your reports that said the year 2021, there were 400 gun-related arrests the first full year with ShotSpotter. 18 of those arrests were tied to the tech.
Yeah. That was one of the interesting things is, you know, that they're already making a lot of arrests, getting a lot of illegal guns off the street. And is it really necessary to bring this technology in to kind of with the goal of getting more guns off the street? Like, is it making much of a difference?
And because when you do the math, it's less than 5%.
Yeah.
But is, you know, less than 5% better than nothing?
Right. Well, then, so, you know, another interesting question, something that we haven't looked at, I don't know that the city's looked at. I recently saw somebody did some research into this in Chicago. And, you know, when you bring ShotSpotter to an area, it increases the number of calls that officers are going on, and increases it by a lot. And the question then becomes, like, what effect is that having overall in the time that it takes officers to respond to calls for a service? So this study looked at, in an area before ShotSpotter got there, what was the, when it was just 911 calls bringing officers in, what was the response time then versus what the response time was when basically officers were being stretched thinner,
sure,
in an area because ShotSpotter was there and they were going on more calls. And they found that there was a considerable increase in response time when you added in the need to respond to ShotSpotter alerts.
Right, because when you have 911, it is incumbent on the citizen or a person out in the community to make the call and alert police, hey, we need your assistance. There's a crime going on here. The idea with ShotSpotter would be that police have control of fielding for potential gun, at least gun-related crimes, and going out themselves.
But
you're saying that's problematic potentially as well?
Yeah. And I mean, you know, one of the reasons for bringing ShotSpotter in that the police site and the company sites is that they found that, you know, maybe like 85% of the gunshots that occur in a given area are not even called in to 911. But this study points out that, like, when you have a 911 call, that it's likely to be more urgent. Either there's someone who, you know, who had their house shot at, who saw something right in front of their door, somebody's lying in the street hurt, that, you know, there is a citizen who feels more of a need for help. And ShotSpotter doesn't differentiate between that situation and a situation where somebody, you know, fires a gun off their back porch, which I'm sure happens. And, you know,
scary.
so they're taking away that kind of
the context.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
So what's the city saying? They've got this $2.7 million contract. It's got to ride out. They're going to decide whether to continue it. What do they say about how effective this technology is and if they think it is a boon to kind of their, you know, platform of defenses against violent gun crime?
I think, you know, the thing that you hear Mayor Justin Bibb point to recently is that they found that it's, you know, they say saved around 12 lives, that because ShotSpotter alerts brought officers to a scene quicker. You know, it does bring, if you look, the average response time between a 911 call and a ShotSpotter alert, an officer arrives at the scene quicker.
Is that right?
On average, when it's a ShotSpotter alert, just because it, you know, kind of eliminates the middle person of the dispatch, and the alert, you know, is supposed to be within like 30 seconds of a gunshot. It gets to an officer. So they have said that in about 12 instances, an officer arrived at a scene and found someone who had been shot who needed immediate medical assistance. And so having ShotSpotter there to get officers there quicker saved some lives. I spoke with Brandon Kutz, who's the former commander of the 4th District and was kind of central in bringing ShotSpotter to Cleveland back in the beginning. It came here from a grant from the Lozick Family Foundation that went through the Cleveland Police Foundation and sort of, you know, kind of was the result of them directly approaching, he told City Council, directly approached him to bring ShotSpotter to the 4th District. And then he left the 4th District and moved to the chief's office and became, in charge of a special project, which basically was to expand ShotSpotter. That was, you know, important part of his job. And what he told me was that, you know, he thought that ultimately the technology served a community policing purpose, that even if it didn't result in a large number of arrests.
Well, I know there was a lot of value to the technology with us, even just showing up and being present, reaching out and talking to the neighbors of where the gunfire occurred and telling them why we were there and being present in the neighborhood.
But then, interestingly, you talk to residents, and you talk to one resident in particular who kind of exemplified the whole notion that maybe more police presence in the neighborhood isn't welcomed by people in the community. Can you talk about that individual?
Yeah, I mean, his name is Trey Williams. He has a small farm in a couple of lots that where his grandmother and his stepdad used to have a house, and he has some beehives and runs an organization called Hood Honey, and you know, during the summer has kids from daycare and from the neighborhood kind of come and learn about keeping bees. And he said that first of all, when I talked to him, he said he had never heard of a ShotSpotter, and he brought up, you know, the sort of flip side of that, that if officers are just coming in that situation where it's like they're looking for a shooter, that, you know, for him, it's not exactly an ideal situation to be interacting with an officer. And so he said that, you know, one day, not that long ago, he was stopped by the police while walking down the street and asked if he'd heard gunshots.
Definitely heard some gunshots. And they came and just asked me, did I hear any gunshots? Of course, I responded with no, because I don't want to be searched. I don't know what their plans are, and I don't know who shot it.
I mean, that speaks to a good point, because the gunshot technology is not going to tell you who has the gun.
Right.
So essentially, if an officer is going into a neighborhood and has evidence that a gunshot was fired somewhere in the region, I mean, that possibility of them, you know, approaching just a random person is an issue. And that's among some of the criticisms of the technology.
Yeah. Yeah. I did some previous reporting on this where I looked at 9 or 10 arrests from early in the use of the technology and looked at the body cam from officers who were responding to ShotSpotter. And what you saw over and over again is that first of all, it still takes about 8 minutes on average, according to the Division of Police, to get to the scene of the shooting from a ShotSpotter alert. So, you know, they're arriving 8 minutes later. The chances of somebody having fired a gun and just kind of standing around in the same spot are slim. And still, they were pulling up to the area, and there were instances after instance where they kind of looked around, and whoever happened to be there, they searched them and used both the fact that it was in, you know, ShotSpotter is only installed in areas where there's high crime and high gun violence. And then the ShotSpotter added on to that was sort of they used as cause to kind of search whoever they came across. And in Cleveland, you know, sadly, people whether or not they are involved in gun violence, feel the need to carry guns to protect themselves.
All right. So Cleveland considering whether to expand the project. I know you're going to keeping your eye on the use of the technology. Dayton police recently decided not to continue their relationship with ShotSpotter, finding that the data didn't show that it was effective. So we'll be keeping our eyes on this. I have a couple minutes left with you and want to ask you about the big news out of Akron. Internal investigation by Akron Police Department found that the 8 officers involved in the shooting death of Jaylen Walker was justified. They were justified in their actions. Tell me more about that and what the implications are.
Yeah, there were sort of two parts of it. You know, on the shooting death of Jaylen Walker, the police department found that because and this is also what the attorney general found. They found that because, you know, based on the law surrounding use of a deadly force by police, it was what they call it, objectively reasonable use of force. So that meant that the officers couldn't be charged. And Chief Milet said that, you know, by extension, it's also not against our policy, which, you know, isn't it? I mean, that you've seen it in Cleveland Police. So many departments have changed their use of force policies to kind of say, okay, there's the legal standard,
sure,
but then there's also, you know, kind of a stricter standard that we want to have to avoid these instances. But in Akron, they've said, you know, we're sticking with the legal standard for use of force. And then the other part of it was that, you know, he cleared officers for some body camera violations and for violations of the police pursuit policy. Also, an officer rammed Walker's car right at the end of the pursuit before Walker got out and rammed the driver's side, which resulted in getting it out on the passenger side, which was a violation of policy. So in those instances, Chief Milet just said, you know, basically because it was such a kind of stressful, high-stakes situation, I'm clearing the officers. So.
Idea Stream criminal justice reporter Matt Richmond, thanks so much for coming in to talk with me.
Thanks for having me.
All right. I know you're always keeping busy with your beat. Time now for a quick break. When we return, we'll preview tonight's City Club of Cleveland discussion about food justice. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We're going to be back soon. You're with The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for staying with us this hour. A recent report from the Department of Agriculture found that more than 44 million Americans live in households dealing with hunger last year, with higher rates of food insecurity for Black and Latino households. The report cites part of that increase is attributed to high food prices due to inflation, but also points out that many households do not have consistent, dependable access to enough food for active, healthy living. A City Club of Cleveland conversation happening tonight at 5:30 at Morningstar Baptist Church will discuss food justice in Cleveland by re-examining the idea of food deserts to instead think of the impact of food apartheid, which national food justice activist Karen Washington says is a, quote, system of segregation that divides those with access to an abundance of nutritious food and those who have been denied that access due to systemic injustice. Joining me to preview this event is the moderator, IdeaStream's Director of Engaged Journalism, Marlene Harris-Taylor. Thanks for coming into the studio. From the other studio, you've been busy this morning.
It was a long trek, Jenny, to get from the other studio.
How many steps
one?
You get in?
About 10.
All right. Well, that's healthy. All right. Well, also joining us by phone is one of tonight's panelists, Kim Foreman, who is the executive director of Environmental Health Watch, one of the region's longest standing environmental justice organizations. Kim, thanks so much for calling in.
Thank you. Hello. Good morning.
Good morning to you. If you have thoughts or questions about food justice in Cleveland or the idea of food apartheid, call us 866-578-0903. Or 216-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org, or you can tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. Kim, I'll start with you. We have discussed the issue of food deserts in Cleveland for years. Most recently last year when Dave's Market announced it was leaving the Collinwood area, a predominantly Black neighborhood, after more than three decades. Other Black neighborhoods like Central and Kinsman have been considered food deserts since 2019. Why do you think it's important to instead use the term food apartheid to really understand the whole problem?
Thank you. So as we talk about the impact and also root causes, we must think about race and a relation of policy and systems change, right? Systems have created some of these issues. And so how do we look at systems change solutions from a policy lens and framework versus a programmatic space? Because programs aren't going to fix the issue. And so we've been working on processing community and resident-led driven solutions, as well as building capacity for residents to then be more involved in policy and system change, as well as institutions think about what they've done to perpetuate the current system in the way they might want to interact differently in neighborhoods and communities and with residents, to then value that lived experience, which then we could come up with solutions that would be real for folks and also deal with root cause issues.
So Marlene, when Kim brings up the whole notion of root causes as opposed to the band-aids and programs that are trying to deal with the issue, I know that the health team at IdeaStream has discussed this root cause, the connection between race and health, through its series Connecting the Dots, including looking at that impact of systemic racism on food security.
Yeah, you mentioned the when Dave's Market closed a year ago and some in the Collinwood neighborhood. Our Lisa Ryan, who has now moved on to another position, did a fantastic report with Stephanie Chekolinski, where they took a look at what the impact of the closing of that supermarket in that neighborhood. And it was a very nuanced look at it, because they talked about how this creates this ongoing problem for the people in the neighborhood about how do I get fresh fruits and vegetables, something that I don't have to think about every day, Jenny. Right. I don't know if you have to think about, like, what, how is it, you know, readily accessible to me because I have a car, and many people don't have cars. And we don't think about the folks in the Cleveland area who don't have cars. I don't know the stat off the top of my head, but it's a large number of people who have transportation issues. So if you take the neighborhood grocery store away, then now they're shopping at the dollar store or somewhere, maybe the corner store that has some vegetables and fruit. And we know that when these, from major studies, we know that when these grocery stores close in neighborhoods, there's an increase in bad health outcomes.
Yeah, Kim, I'd love to hear your perspective on that, the idea of one's proximity to a resource that has those healthy options as being, you know, directly related to their health outcomes.
Right. So there's two areas in which we try to tackle this. There's the current food cooperative through Central Kent Wellness Collaborative, which puts the residents in the center of the process of thinking about a food cooperative or business model that then addresses the food apartheid, but also puts them in the center of creating the systems change that they want to see. And that's it's a long process, but it's also engaging decision makers and building relationships first, so that we can hear each other, listen to each other, and craft solutions. And environmental justice, just to say, which food justice, environmental justice is really about people making informed decisions and also participating in the change. So I've been in a lot of conversations talking about the issue, about the data, about the people. We really need to partner with residents and come up with this multi-sector intergenerational process to get at the issue. We've also done things like Easy Does It cooking classes, because as we work on systems change and as we think about development, it takes a longer time. So in the midst of all of that, what do we do right now? How do we support people where they are right now? And so we've done things like Easy Does It cook classes, show people how to shop at the perimeter and take people on field trips to the West Side Market and think about budget. And so with things that are programs are great for engagement and to be way more intentional to understand what's going on. So that when we get to the table to think about solutions and policies, we've been working with folks, having real conversations and developing through these processes, you know, how then we get at something, right? Because the residents that participated on skin classes came from Central Kinsman, came from Wood Hill, and they were explaining the health issues that they were facing but didn't know what to do. You know, they have access to a community garden, but they don't know what to do with the vegetables, right? So down to the, like, core and basics around how are people engaging with the system, and then what are those things in the interim as we work on system change that we can do, you know, as direct service. So, like, Youth Farmers Leadership was the next generation of potential farmers to understand farm to table and also get the technical skills to grow food and what that looks like, right? So there's this both and approach that we've been working on for at least 15 years.
Well, Jenny, you know, I think what's really, one of the things that's really interesting in this conversation is you and I are talking about, like, food deserts, and that's sort of been the way we've talked about these areas that don't have grocery stores or fresh food. But now there's this concept of food apartheid. And I think that's an interesting change in just the language and thinking about this problem. And because Kim is talking about a systems change, and I think that that food apartheid label kind of gets us into the thinking of systems more so.
So tell me what you mean by that. I mean, I think I kind of understand, but I think it invites a historical perspective into the fact that you might go into a neighborhood where people are poorer, where there's not as much education about food, and go, why isn't there a grocery store here? So when you're talking about food apartheid, and then I know a term that we, you know, we're always reporting on here, redlining.
Yes.
And its huge impact on Cleveland, you know, major neighborhoods all around the country. How does redlining impact what we know now as food deserts in our area?
I'd love to hear Kim's thought on this too, but I think that's a great point that people are also calling it food redlining now. So to the question you asked, Jenny, around, when, you know, you ride in a neighborhood and you wonder, why aren't there grocery stores here? Those titles get to the why. Because when it's a food desert, you think, oh, it's just something that just happened. These stores just happen to leave. And often there's good business reasons that these stores have to leave, right? But when you think of it as food apartheid, then you think of something that's been more intentional, that there has been systems behind creating these areas. Did I get that right, Kim?
Yeah, well, I think also another perspective around using a word and desert is almost like there's nothing there. So I think sometimes we talk about disinvested communities, we act like there's no one there who cares or no one there who's working on the issue just because they're not on everybody else's radar. There are people there, there's life there, and there's folks who actually want to change their communities. And a lot of times, I think we don't value that or lift that up, right? We're so busy talking about what's wrong, which we need to address, but there are other ideas around what's happening in those communities and lifting that up as well to shine a light on possibilities, to shine a light on assets, right? While we know this is a problem, but then when do we shift from looking at data and just talking about the disparity to, okay, how do we instill hope and then move toward practical application solutions, and well as have residents and decision makers talking to each other and working together, because those policies, those intentional policies, were based on who the decision makers valued, right? So then we start to build these other types of relationships and demonstrate value as people with the lived experience, and they should be at the same table.
That's a great segue into talking about the the conversation tonight.
Yeah, let's talk about that. What are some of the organizations that are going to be participating in this conversation?
Yeah, so Kim is talking about the fact that there are people there who are working, who are trying to find solutions. So many people know Cayman Durden III. He's the co-founder of Riddall Green Partnership. And that's the group that took this huge area of land that was in the Kinsman Central neighborhood, acres of land there. And many years ago, I believe it was around 10 years ago, they started this idea of let's reclaim this land. Let's actually create urban farming on this land. And they have slowly been growing out that area and creating a more sustainable area where food is actually being produced and it's actually being supplied to people who have restaurants, African-American folks who are running businesses. It's being made available to the area with an eye on solutions and sustainable solutions. Also, Shirley Bell Wheeler, who's also an urban farmer at the Revolutionary Love Urban Farms. Shirley is newer to the space, but she's also thinking of how to grow businesses beyond just the farming, using this as a kickoff, right? To create other kind of businesses on this property. And in doing, also showing other people how they can do the same thing. So it's going to be a great conversation. And of course, Kim is going to be there to talk about all the wonderful work she has been doing over the years, because Kim has been like the backbone of some of the thinking around this in this community.
And Kim, I know that your organization's leading a grant that's bringing food options to Cleveland Central and Kinsman neighborhoods, working with the Cleveland Department of Public Health as well.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we have let me say this. The residents and the team have been working since about 2016, 17. So we have the grant, but we've been working together and committed for years with Money Without Money. So, yes, Bill Health Challenge, which is my third Bill Health grant, we just received a national 3-year award to really dig into the weeds of the work. And then we can start executing on that and also leverage that to then look at the site assessments and whatever the community wants to do, as well as activate committees to invite others to participate and recruit residents who want to work on the change and then think about the development and then how that would look to actually implement and execute a cooperative that has been developed by community.
An important conversation happening in full tonight at the City Club of Cleveland. It's conversation on food justice. It's happening tonight at 5:30 p.m. The location, Morningstar Baptist Church in Cleveland's East Side. We'll have a link to the event on today's show page, ideastream.org/ideas. Now, I want to thank our guests for joining us. Kim Foreman, the Executive Director of Environmental Health Watch, thanks so much for calling in. And our own Marlene Harris-Taylor, IdeaStream's Director of Engaged Journalism. Now, you have to scoot back to the studio.
I got to go back to talk more about our Hunger Challenge.
I love that. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you, Jenny, for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you. Now, to get the last word on today's topic, send an email to soi@ideastream.org. We're on Twitter at Sound of Ideas. You can follow me at @JennyHamill_. Tomorrow on the Sound of Ideas, we'll look at a new pair of reports from Team NEO and Cuyahoga Community College on where the unfilled jobs are in our region, looking specifically at the gig economy. If you missed any portion of the program, find us online or listen to the Sound of Ideas podcast. I am Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back with you again tomorrow.